Welcome back, Warriors, to our third episode of Pacificast. Today's topic is Safeguarding Our Oceans, the 30 by 30 Global Initiative.
My name is Leela Devine, and I'm a senior at Waikea High School. I'm a lab member at the Daniel K. Inouye College of Pharmacy at the University of Hawaii at Hilo, and I have research focuses on marine pharmacology and cancer. I'm also an Earth Echo Youth Leadership Council member.
I'm Lycan Forster. I'm just a regular old senior who can't even pronounce regular, apparently.
And I'm Taylor McCann, a junior at Waikea High School. So today we're going to be talking about the 30 by 30 Global Initiative. So Leela, do you want to give us a quick overview of what exactly that means? What this initiative is about?
Okay, I'm going to give like a baseline definition of 30 by 30, basically why it's kind of being put forward and what is its significance. So it's a call to action to safeguard at least 30% of the world's ocean by 2030 through a network of highly protected marine areas where no destructive or extractive activities like fishing or mining can take place. And this is done through this thing called Marine Protected Areas, or MPAs. So they're areas of the ocean that are set aside for long-term conservation aims. They are the only mainstream conservation-focused and area-based measure to increase the quality and extent of global protection. And MPAs and their network offer nature-based solutions to support global efforts towards climate change adaptation and mitigation.
Yo, those MPAs sound tight as heck. Tell us more, Leela.
You said that MPAs offer nature-based solution to support global efforts. Could you tell me what a nature-based, like an example of a nature-based solution is?
So a lot of times MPAs are put forward to increase the overall biodiversity of the area. So sometimes that means closing off areas for the public and putting these things called no-take areas into place. So that's where that might be completely closing off an area that humans literally cannot go to. And what this does is it allows the reef to naturally rehabilitate itself back to the state that it was originally in. A lot of times what people do for what you call strictly nature-based solutions is they end up planting coral in a bunch of different areas. So sometimes you'll see areas where corals are starting to bleach, but people will start projects in which they get species of that coral and they'll start strategically planting them in certain areas and then letting them grow in these no-take zones. And what that does is it just helps the overall area of the reef flourish, and that kind of brings a lot to the biodiversity.
So when you guys like implement these solutions, like making no take zones and stuff, once like the reefs are able to like replenish themselves and like restore themselves to like, I guess, their full potential, what is done after that? Like, do you have to like keep maintaining this area as a no take area and like keep tourists out, keep people out, to like help the area thrive? Or then at that point, is it okay to take off the like no take zone? Because I'd imagine if you did, it would just go back to no bueno again. But
yeah, so it kind of depends on how severe the coral bleaching situation is, or like the habitat degradation or whatever was happening in that area. Maybe some areas are specific to mining, or oil extraction is a big one. There's a thing called fracking, and if you Google like pictures, sometimes you'll see like extremely large structures just like in the middle of the ocean. And so imagine like trying to extract oil from the ground, and you have like the surrounding like marine area, and that's just like being completely wrecked. And so
marine extractive activities.
So MPAs can come in a variety of different forms, and it's managed by all different levels of government. So I guess the answer to your question would be totally dependent on how severe the situation is in that area. So there's marine sanctuaries, research reserves, ocean parks, and marine wildlife places. And that basically, you're trying to protect the ecosystem and preserve those cultural resources. And so that's kind of like the next step after. If you have that area as a no-take zone, you could change it, maybe make it become a marine sanctuary, make it become a research reserve or a ocean park. And all of these places mainly focus on keeping that biodiversity into place. But there's all these different levels that you can have it at, which will allow for different species to maybe jump back from any potential low points that they had from any of these activities.
I understand. So, like, there's different types of MPAs, but they're created based off of the needs. So one might have don't go here at all because we really messed up here.
Yeah.
And then others are like, don't fish, but you can still swim.
And then that kind of helps to determine, like, once things are good, what you should do with the area, you know? Because if it was a minor issue, then you can kind of, like, open it back up to the public, I guess. And if it was major and you guys kind of, like, got it to the point where it's, like, thriving again, then, like, to prevent that from happening, you could use it as, like, a research site. That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, so I would say it also depends on the depth of the area, right? So some areas, a lot of times, shallower-based reefs are impacted more by the effects of ocean acidification and rising water temperatures, mainly because those are the ones that are hit first, right? And then you see, depending on the type of activity that's in place, you might have somewhere that's 100 feet down that has been impacted by, like, certain fishing activities and stuff like that. And that would require, like, different types of attention being put towards those areas. So it really depends on where in the reef it is. A lot of times geographic location has different types of reef.
Only 7.5% of the ocean is protected, but only less than 2% of the whole ocean is actually covered by exclusively no-take MPAs.
So what 30-30 is trying to, 30 by 30 is trying to do is get at least 30% covered by marine protected areas with no-take zones, or just, like, marine protected areas?
Basically, marine protected areas in general. No-take zone is kind of like the last resort for a lot of these places. And note that it's actually, the actual stat here is, we say less than 2% is covered exclusively by no-take MPAs, but it's actually just over 1.89. And so the percentage will change depending on where you get your data. So not all parks are protected equally, not all areas are protected equally, and many are what we call paper parks, which means that they're protected on paper, but they're not properly protected in real life. So keep that in mind when you're looking at any stats, is that there's, like, that statistical gap between like what a little actually bit of leeway might be happening and what's, like, not actually put into place. Let's go back to my last point here. Sponges are at risk due to rising acidity levels because they tend to thrive in rockier habitats and shallower based areas. And what that means is these areas are the first to experience rising acidity levels, and they cannot adjust to the rapidly changing pH of the water in that area. Of course, it's dependent on where in the world it is and how severe ocean acidification is on those general areas, but they're also, these areas are also the first to experience any harsh temperature changes. So a lot of times it's trying to adapt to that homeostasis, which is really what puts these species at risk, especially softer-based organisms. So what you're seeing in the sponges and soft corals.
Wow, that does not sound good. That I can imagine. Okay, but then I guess that would lead you to the question, why are these sponges and soft corals important? Like, are there any examples you have of specific organisms that you think are very vital to us or could be very vital to us?
Yes. So this is what I found in my research. Perfect segue, don't we think?
Perfect.
So, perfect segue. So my research that I did, basically, I collected a series of corals and sponges from all around the reef. So not necessarily just soft corals and sponges, but also I collected hard corals, and I had around 16 different types that I collected. This was with a permit with the DNLR, just like a heads up in case anyone's like, yo, you collected those illegally. I did not. I got permission from the government, just a heads up.
Just
let me preface this. And so what I was actually able to find is softer based organisms have a higher strain isolation potential. And what that means is when I collected these species of sponges and soft corals, what I did is I isolated endophytes from them. And that's a type of fungal strain that resides internally in different species tissues. And what those do is, you can isolate a bunch of different compounds from them to be used in the pharmaceutical industry, or basically to create new types of drugs depending on the polarity of that compound and its activities. And so from this, what we found is softer based organisms You can get more types of strains from them, and therefore you can get more types of compounds that can be used in pharmaceuticals. And when my lab and I tested these against cancer cell lines, what we found is these softer-based organisms are actually the ones that exhibit more anti-cancerous capabilities against prostate and ovarian cancer cell lines. So that's basically going to show that there's a lot in our reefs that we don't know about. For example, my type of research that I've been doing has been replicated and done through plants. That's where it originated from. Is it originated from plants? And there has been some experimentation done on like extremely deep sea like samples, but none of it has really been done in these like offshore marine environments that are easily accessible to us. So I think it's really important to look at accessibility and how effective some of these are, not only in the pharmaceutical sphere, which is my example, that's just because that's what I've personally experienced, but there's a lot of potential for so much out there that just hasn't been explored.
But with Taylor's question about like which ones are important and stuff, like, I mean, I guess we're talking about coral, which a lot of the coral we have like on our reefs, we've like discovered it obviously, and we like know about it, but let me pull up the only statistic that I researched. There's like 95% of the ocean that has been undiscovered. So like, we just want to protect it so that we can figure out what's there. Cause we might be unknowingly like killing
off something. Yeah. So that's
like vital to these ecosystems.
I said, did you make an endophyte stem cell? And you were explaining why that's dumb. Yeah.
Basically what you do is you collect a coral or a soft coral or a sponge or whatever species, and you get these plates of media. Usually they're in the form of agar. And you transfer the coral onto the plate, and you basically like cut off small segments, like small subsamples, and you put them on these plates, and you'll start to see endophytes grow. And what that means is they can come in a bunch of different shapes and colors, but it's basically like the one that I found that was anti-cancerous is kind of like a white fuzz, and it grows in the shape of a snowflake. That's the source of the compounds that I'm looking for. So it's not actually the coral. It's a type of fungal strain that's found within the coral. And okay. What you can do is you can cut out a piece of that endophyte and you can put it on another plate and it'll keep on growing in the incubator. So you basically just created this like infinite source of compounds that you can just keep on sampling from for more and more research.
Okay, this and is... So
what's really fun about that is you can store it in a freezer at negative 80 degrees Celsius. And you can pull it out 2 years later and stick it on a plate, and you can keep on doing research.
Is there something important about the temperature, 80 degrees Celsius?
It basically just makes it so there's no outside like contamination. So one of the biggest things when you're growing these is a lot of times, because there's a lot of particulate matter in the air, and if they get onto these plates, what will happen is they'll start growing. And so sometimes if there's contamination, you'll have this like white endophyte strain, but you'll see like a bunch of like black fuzzy stuff like starting to grow over it. And that's literally contamination. So what cutting a small piece and preserving it in that freezer does is it basically just creates like that one like lifeline source that you have that you can just pull out whenever you want.
Okay, so for anyone wondering, negative 80 degrees Celsius, was that what you said?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that is negative 176 degrees Fahrenheit, so a fairly cold temperature. Okay, so you know if you, like, pardon my morbidness, if you cut a worm in half, like, they can grow into their own separate worms.
That is so true.
That's what you're talking about. Because if you cut the endophyte in half, then they can both like regenerate. Yeah, so
if you cut the endophyte and you put it on another plate, it'll just start growing because it likes to grow on media. That's like its natural thing.
Wait, that's
like a host, right?
Also,
yeah. So yeah. So the coral is basically
I'm gonna
the host.
Start cutting worms in half and growing my little worm arm.
No, don't. Oh my god,
it's wrong.
I was about to make a comment on what Taylor said because the coral or the sponge is the host of the endophyte. It's a host species.
Yeah, because it's not. That's why it's not only. It's not like something specific in the coral. It's just something found in the coral because it needs something to like attach itself to. So if you're only. We were talking about how this sort of endophyte, is that the term?
Yeah.
Yeah, that it can be found in more things than just coral. That's just what your research is on and what you know of at the time. So in theory, do you think it would be possible for other kinds of corals or sea sponges to have other kinds of endophytes that could like possibly help cure or help, that could possibly help cure other kinds of cancer? Because I know your research is primarily on like ovarian and prostate cancer. But is there, do you think, because I know you know more about how this works than me, like, is there other types of endophytes that can be found in nature that could help with other things?
There's a term here, let me make sure I get the right definition, natural products. And so natural products are basically anything that is produced by life. It includes the likes of biotic materials. And what you see from them are these things called secondary metabolites, and those are different compounds found within natural products. So this is where I can elaborate a little bit on some of my experiences with environmental work, because I do a lot of lab work, but recently I've gotten into a lot more environmental work. So as I briefly said in my introduction, which now seems like ages ago, I mentioned that I was a youth leadership council member for Earth Echo International. And this is just an example of trying to give youth voice in taking climate action wherever they go. And so I'm on a committee called the Youth Leadership Council. And what that is every year they you basically apply and you have to go through like an interview process and stuff. And you have to have some prior experience. But what they do is this year, at least for my year, they chose 16 people globally to be on this board. And there's around, there's a few other, I think there are, I don't know how many total, but this year for my term, it's a 2-year term and they choose 16 people globally. And what you do is you're able to work towards creating a lot of new environmental initiatives. And what we're trying to emphasize here is the importance of youth in the environmental sphere. And so what that means is, at least on the board that I'm on, you see people from a bunch of different backgrounds. You see people who have started their own environmental initiatives and environmental organizations. You see people that are interested in politics and policy. For me, there's a couple of us that do a lot of research. There's some people who express the urgency behind taking these environmental initiatives through arts, the humanities, and poetry, right? So there's a whole bunch of different people. And what we end up doing is we start working on outreach. We're trying to stress the importance of youth having a voice in the environmental movement, because we're the ones that are going to be affected by this. And so it's important to start getting youth to be able to start sitting on these boards. Maybe have one or two sit on the board of directors, or have them actually go. There's a couple of, I don't exactly know how many, but I know there's a few that have gone to like Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. and have sat in on like environmental like regulation meetings to try to see. And so as of May 2020, Trump has rolled back approximately 64 environmental regulations, which have taken years for us to put up, right? So that's like years of environmental work, and it was all down the drain through a couple of signatures. And so what's really important
here, I love fascism!
Woohoo! And so what's really important here is to start getting our next generation prepped. And so I think if I had a message to all of the older people that are in office and that are trying to help us, is get youth to start sitting in on the initiatives that you are starting.
Okay, so restating 30 by 30 is protect 30% of the Earth's oceans by 2030. But have they put forth like these are the places that we want to get protected, or is there like a criteria? What like solid steps are being taken besides we want to do this and then people have to like figure out how to do it themselves? Like,
this is one of my personal biggest criticisms towards, you see like these environmental speakers and they're here to like inspire youth, and they're like, we got all these initiatives going for you guys, here's the 30 by 30 movement, and this is like what I've done in my career, yay, hopefully I inspired you. But the thing about that is like no one's really taking action, right? It's still stagnant. So
there's like no mapped out, like these are the places that we want to protected. No, hey, you guys over in Vietnam, I don't know. Is it Vietnam? Vietnam. The ocean? I'm so sorry. I just named a random country. These countries over here, you guys get this ocean protected and stuff. Like, there's nothing like that.
Okay, so there is, I feel like it depends on the organization. So a bunch of different organizations have different areas that are targeted and that are put into place. For example, the one that I'm at, Earth Echo, has around 5 or 6 different locations. And National Geographic has some really cool dive expeditions that they go on to make all of this work and to work on this rehabilitation stuff. And so a bunch of different organizations have different target areas. And so I really feel like it's dependent on the organization and what their personal goals are in order to try to make this 30 by 30 initiative go into place. So some people focus on like the northern area. Some people, I've seen people from Nat Geo go into Antarctica and do like deep sea under ice diving. Some people are focused on the tropics, but all of this, we're having these organizations start on this initiative and we're having them focus on different areas of the world in order to make this like a global collaborative effort, basically.
How long does it generally take to get these places protected?
It depends on the area. It really depends on how severe it is. For example, I'm just going to give you a couple of examples here. There's a national marine park called Cabo Pulmo. I don't know if I necessarily pronounced that right, but it's been named by Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and it called it one of the world's most robust marine reserves. So it's located near the southern end of Baja California in the Sea of Cortez. It was established in 1995 by local citizens, and it was enforced as a no-take restriction zone. And after around 10 years, they found that the total fish biomass in the reserve increased by more than 460% from 1999 to 2009. The biomass of top predators increased by 11 times over the same period, and the biomass of carnivores increased by 4 times. And so authors of that study has said that the fish communities at a depleted site can recover to a level comparable to that of a remote, pristine site that has never been fished before by humans. And so it's technically like a 15-year span, but the study was done in a span of 10 years. And so seeing that 460% increase in fish biomass in 10 years is something that really speaks to the power of marine protected areas. From the youth perspective, for example, with the Habitat Restoration Committee that I'm on, focusing on Ocean Echo 30 by 30, which is Earth Echo's approach to 30 by 30, and collaborating with these areas. So we're seeing Plymouth, England, Argentina, Florida, California, Hawaii, and Virginia. So I'm the Hawaii connection. What we're trying to do as a first, like, initial, because this is like the very first group of people that's working on this initiative as part of Earth Echo and the YLC, is collectively restoring at least 1 mile of shoreline/coastal habitat in those areas, right? So it's a very, very small effort, but it's definitely something that's initial that a lot of people are starting to work on. So imagine speaking at these summits and getting a bunch of different environmental organizations to start these movements and to actually understand the importance of 30 by 30. If you have the resources, you should get started. Why? Because it's definitely something that basically we've been talking about this whole time, the importance of the ocean and what it can actually do for us.
Are you like saying that for like anyone can do that? I mean, not anyone, but is that what you're kind of saying? Like,
it depends. Okay, so it all kind of boils down to who has the resources, right? And so it's really trying to get the general public into these like groups, into these volunteer teams, into advocacy and into doing climate strikes and like advocating for the ocean. That's something that's really important that we need to get started, that has been getting started, but definitely from my perspective and my experience in the environmental sphere hasn't been on a roll as far as like, hasn't been on a really nice roll.
Yeah. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Pacific Cast. This episode was produced and edited by Taylor McCann and researched by Leela, me, and Taylor.
Our music was created by Lycan Forrester, who created our cover and is our executive producer.
Pacific Cast is a part of the media made by Kaleo Kekoa, Waikea High School's official reporting source. Visit us at www.kaleokekoa.weebly.com.